Start your day with Morning Edition and wind it down with All Things Considered, only on KPBS. From global headlines to local stories, stay informed, inspired, and connected. Tune in daily or listen anytime at kpbs.org.
Joe Bob Briggs is on a crusade.
I've been on this crusade, this losing crusade, to bring Walpurgis Nacht to America.
And he doesn't understand why everyone's not celebrating it.
It's a great holiday because it's all about witches. It's about lots of horror themes. And it's about alcohol. There are so many alcohols associated with this holiday.
Welcome back to listener-supported KPBS Cinema Junkie. I'm Beth Accomando. Tonight, April 30th, is Walpurgis Nacht, also known as Witches' Night. So, no better time than now to speak with Joe Bob Briggs, the host of Shudder's The Last Drive-In. He's on a crusade to get Walpurgis Nacht declared, and more importantly, celebrated as a national holiday, so we can drink all those Witches' Night brews. We'll also get to discuss how he ended up as a guru of Grindhouse on three networks, and why he champions these drive-in movies. After listening, you can decide if you too want to join his mutant family. I need to take one quick break, and then I'll be back with Joe Bob Briggs.
Hey, everybody, have you heard the news? Joe Bob is back in town. He's over at the drive-in, hanging around. Watch a crazy movie, so come on down to Joe Bob's Last Drive-In Show. Blood, beast, is boobies, and more. Joe Bob's Last Drive-In Show.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Paint Care, offering households and businesses in California more than 800 leftover paint drop-off sites for recycling. Quantities of 100-plus gallons of paint may qualify for a large volume pickup. Learn more at paintcare.org.
Welcome back to Cinema Junkie. I'm Beth Accomando. I'm not sure how many public radio listeners are also fans of Joe Bob Briggs, so I asked him to describe his show for those who might be completely unfamiliar with it.
Well, I have a history with public radio. I have shocked the listeners of public radio a couple of times. Not recently. But the show that I do now, The Last Drive-In, is a movie hosting show in which we break into the movie and we do deep analysis of the movie in what we hope is a fun way. We are basically dealing with what used to be called exploitation films. They're now called genre films. I still call them exploitation films, almost exclusively horror films on the Shudder Network. So in the course of talking about these films, we develop a family of like-minded people who tune in every time we're on. And of course, since it's a streaming network, they rewatch the shows a lot. But I mean, that's the best I can describe it. It's a show that's developed over a period of, I've done the same show three times. I did the show on the Movie Channel starting in the 80s. I did it on TNT starting in the 90s, a show called Monster Vision. And I'm doing it a third time. When they came to me and said, hey, we'd like you to do a show on Shudder, I was like, okay, what kind of show are we going to do? And they goes, well, we want that same show. And I'm like, what?
A double feature every week hosted by Joe Bob Briggs, written by Joe Bob Briggs, directed by Joe Bob Briggs, produced by Joe Bob Briggs. I'll be working the camera. I'll be working the sound. Special effects by Joe Bob Briggs. Lighting by Joe Bob Briggs, with a special appearance by one or two guests who will be fascinating, not for their intrinsic value as people, but because they're being interviewed by Joe Bob Briggs, me, kicking ass on The Last Drive-In, the series. I'll be kicking so much ass, I'll probably kick my own ass.
you can't repeat TV. You know, you're not supposed to repeat TV. And they said, no, 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 we want that exact same show. And I was like, okay. And so these elements that we have on the show have been built up over decades. And I've been fortunate. I've never had a time limit on the show. When I was on the movie channel, that was a premium network. And so it didn't matter when the movie started and when it was over. And so I was on at the beginning of the movie and at the end of the movie. When I was on TNT, I was on in the middle of the night. And so they said to me, as long as you're done by 6 a.m., we don't care when you finish. And that meant I could finish at 3, I could finish at 5. They didn't care. So my segments were as long or as short as I wanted them to be. And we would interrupt the movie at every commercial break. We would talk. So there was no time limit there. And then now I'm on a streaming network where they don't care either. You know, and so, in fact, I was shocked. I said, what do you want me to do? Just introduce the movie? And they were like, oh, no, we want to have those breaks like you had at TNT. And I was like, but you have no commercials. And they said, well, no, but we still want the breaks. I said, you want commercial breaks on a non-commercial network? And they said, yeah. And I said, that's going to make people angry. And they said, no, we think this will work. And so, lo and behold, it worked. People tune in they don't mind the breaks. We have an average of 5 in each movie, besides the introduction of the movie and the wrap-up of the movie.
Yeah, but you're not exactly a commercial. You know, you pack those breaks with all sorts of information and fun stuff and even interviews with filmmakers.
That's true. Sometimes we bring the filmmaker on. Sometimes we bring some of the actors on. A lot of times we're dealing with the background of movies that nobody else cares about. I mean, these are not exactly the movies that are get nominated for the Academy Award, you know. Although, occasionally we do what they call the elevated horror movies. I don't particularly like that term, but there is a subgenre called elevated horror. I don't even exactly know what it means, but we sort of become the Criterion Collection of horror occasionally when we're doing a certain type of movie. Usually the ones that have some kind of like super intellectual backstory, like Exorcist 3 is one example, just simply because it has so much Catholic eschatology and symbolism and all this stuff in it.
Well, Catholicism, as a lapsed Catholic, is like one of the best foundations for horror ever, I think.
It is. There is a subgenre called Catholic horror, you know.
Yes.
That started with The Exorcist, continued with The Omen, and then disintegrated from there. But it's like, especially in Italy, there's a whole lot of Catholic horror.
Well, and I mean, I just think so many directors were raised Catholic or have Catholicism in their background that even if it's not overtly in their films, like having the Bible read to you or seeing Christ on the cross in the church in sometimes very gruesome manner will haunt you.
That's true. I mean, when people complain about the blood and gore in some of the movies that we show, I always point out that none of them compare to Passion of the Christ.
Exactly. Well, what I love about your show is that you do mix really entertaining breaks, but you also pack it with so much information sometimes. And sometimes you send us that information in like in a massively rapid fire approach that is very impressive.
Well, I get carried away. I mean, one of the shows I'm very proud of is the show we did, Nosferatu, on the 100th anniversary of the original silent classic Nosferatu. We broke all the rules of TV, which is never show silent films, never show subtitled films, never show black and white films, never show foreign films. And so we not only showed black and white, subtitled, and foreign, we showed the exact same film twice because we showed the 1979 remake, German remake. And in the course of it, well, we dressed in the costumes of 1820s Germany, Biedermeier costume. And there are massive backstories to both of those movies. And so we had a lot of fun with that. But the main thing was I wanted to see if it was possible to do that programming and still have the audience stay with us. And man, did they stay with us. They still talk to me about that show. They love that show. And these are people who also love, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street and Friday the 13th. And so you don't really expect them to become huge Nosferatu fans, but they did.
There was a society party to celebrate the premiere of the first Dracula movie, the greatest horror film of the 1920s and the only horror film up to that time that was also considered an art film. I speak, of course, of Nosferatu, A Symphony of Horror, which many regard as the first real masterpiece of horror. There were earlier horror films, of course. There were at least 10 short horror films made as early as the 1890s, most of them in France. But it was in Germany after World War I that a group of writers and actors and set designers who had all trained at the famous Max Reinhardt Theater School gathered together to create horror films that used the most modern special effects they could come up with to create frightening stories with hidden occult messages embedded in them. Because the founder of the studio that made Nosferatu was Alban Grau, a famous occultist. And the screenwriter was a member of the Order of Rosicrucians. And the director, F.W. Murnau, was an openly gay man who loved to break the rules, both the rules of filmmaking and the rules of society. And he liked the occult because it was all about shadows.
It's an amazing film, yes. So is the remake. So is the 1979 mm-hmm. remake, just in a different way, but also an incredible film. The most gratifying thing I hear from people is my wife, husband, boyfriend, girlfriend never liked horror until I introduced him to your show. and now he's a horror fanatic. He wants to see everything. So I like being the gateway drug, and I like being the one that converts people into wanting. Horror fans are different. They don't want to just see this year's horror film. They want to see every horror film from every decade. And so once you get the bug, you know, I've got you for life.
Raise your right hand and repeat after me. We are drive-in mutants. We are not like other people. We are sick. We are disgusting. If life had a vomit meter, we'd be off the scale. We believe in blood, in breasts, and in beasts. We believe in Kung Fu City.
As long as one drive-in remains on the planet Earth,
we will party like jungle animals. We will boogie till we puke. Heads will roll. The drive-in will never die. Amen.
Now, you do have something special coming up for Walpurgisnacht this year. You do this quite often. Is there anything you can reveal about it? Sometimes you don't reveal the titles in advance, but...
Yeah, we don't reveal the titles in advance. I kind of wish we did this year, but we can't. But I've been on this crusade, this losing crusade, to bring Walpurgisnacht to America. Walpurgisnacht is the other pagan holiday, the second most important pagan holiday after Halloween, Halloween is based on Samhain. It is immensely popular in Germany and other parts of Europe, and it is all about witches. It's about burning the witches before they get to the Hexentanzplatz, the witches' dance floor, where they cavort with Satan. Cavort meaning debauchery, you know. And so it's a great holiday because it's all about witches. It's about lots of horror themes, and it's about alcohol. There are so many alcohols associated with this holiday. There are beers and drinks that are only made for this holiday. It's always the night of April 30th and the morning of May 1st, dusk to dawn, when the creatures of hell and the creatures of the present get very close together and can cross over the line. And so it's a huge holiday in Europe, not so much here. And yet people have these halfway to Halloween parties. Well, you don't have to have a halfway to Halloween party. You've got a pagan holiday right here that you can celebrate. And I think it's partly the name, Walpurgisnacht. It's hard to say. It's hard to remember. We should just change it to Witches' Night, you know, and either be a witch or burn the witches. Take be team witch or team, what do they call them? The witch finder generals. Mm-hmm. But it's a great, fun, spooky holiday. And I've been trying to like get people to embrace it and start celebrating it and make it as big as Halloween. But so far, I'm shouting into the wilderness, and I think it's the name. No one can get around that German name.
I work with a group that programs films here, and we just screened Mark of the Devil and we gave out the replicas of the vomit bags that were from the 70s, and I made Walpurgisnacht soup to go with it.
Oh, that's perfect.
We had a professor come, and she teaches about witches in history, and specifically looking to like who the victims were and in these like witch hunts and stuff. But what was interesting was, even though Mark of the Devil was obviously mining that material for the most like sensational and kind of gruesome stuff, there was a lot of actual like real tidbits of history in there that had some real resonance to it, surprisingly to some.
Yeah, I mean, I like the movies that start with the premise that there were no witch hunts, the witches were real. We have one of those coming up this Friday night on our Walpurgisnacht show. It would not be on anybody's top 10 list, but it's actually one of my favorite movies.
Oh, all right. I'll look forward to finding out what that is then. And another thing that you do that's a lot of fun with the films is you do your drive-in totals. So do you personally do all those counts every time?
I hope you're not implying I would falsify a breast count.
Or let someone else do it, I guess.
No, I do. I do the drive-in totals, yes. I take extensive notes. Sometimes it requires freeze frames to know if something qualifies for a drive-in to count on the drive-in totals.
So let's look at those drive-in totals and get started. We have 27 dead bodies, 27 undead bodies, 6 breasts, multiple gunshots to the head, 1 grieving horny widow, decayed shroud sniffing, ignis fatuus. You know what ignis fatuus is, Darcy?
Those flickering lights in the swamp.
Spoken like a true South Carolina girl, yes. Anywhere you have decaying organic matter and moisture, you get this stuff called ignis fatuus. I'm surprised I've never seen it before in a horror flick. Aardvarking on a fresh grave, 1 cross through the cranium, grave digging, projectile vomiting, 1 motorcycle from beyond the grave, skull reassembly for no apparent reason, shoulder munching, head butting, iron vase face evisceration, penile phobia, 1 unlikely cure for penile phobia, 1 voluntary chemical castration, multiple murder sprees, 1 reanimated disembodied head, gratuitous inner monologuing, gratuitous lute playing, head rolls twice. In other words, 1 head rolls, but it rolls twice. Another thing I've never seen before in a movie.
You know, what do you think it is about these films that kind of give them their staying power? Because we were doing a show and we were talking about, we picked a Black actress to highlight for Black History Month. And my co-host and I decided we wanted to talk about Pam Grier. And now, granted, you know, someone like Cicely Tyson or Ruby Dee probably has more awards or is considered to have amassed more respected work. But the thing is like, they're not on T-shirts and their movies aren't being screened in movie theaters today. So what is it, do you think, about these like exploitation films or these genre films that really have more kind of impact and staying power sometimes than the more like mainstream or?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the rebel element. It's the spitting in the eye of the establishment element, which is what all those exploitation directors were doing, partly as marketing. But, you know, Pam Grier wasn't just, or she is a great actress.
Yes.
But she's not just a great actress. She was a marketing tool. in a way that Cicely Tyson would not be. And so having the sexy Pam Grier in your movie was something that made it an exploitation film. There were a few actors like Richard Roundtree, Fred Williamson, that were marquee names in the blaxploitation era. They consistently delivered audience, and that's what exploitation films are all about. Exploitation is a marketing term. Mm-hmm. It means the film has something exploitable that other films don't have. But I think the reason that people watch them 20 years later, 30 years later, 40 years later, is that, hey, I can't believe they were doing this. They're raw, and they are, they're primal. They're primal. They're just, they go to the basics in what we care about. I mean, most of them are full of sex and violence. Now, if you don't like something, you say, yeah, it's full of sex and violence. If you like it, you say, it was so full of romance and adventure. And so, you know, if it's mainstream, it's romance and adventure. But, you know, but if it's exploitation, it's sex and violence. But there are good versions of that, and there are bad versions of that. But a lot of these films were overlooked or neglected because they were made on a low budget for the drive-in circuit or the grindhouse circuit.
You do show a lot of these, quote-unquote, exploitation films or horror films. And they're films that are very easily accessible. I mean, horror is something everybody can enjoy and, you know, get into because it's like so primal. But then you do give them all this other like context and information. So, yeah, I mean, I can see easily how this can be a gateway to more films. Or
all great horror is in the subtext. Mm-hmm. And so we end up talking about the subtext because it's easy with all the technical tricks of cinema to scare somebody, to make them jump. Mm-hmm. That's the easy part. The hard part is getting down into the primal fears. Mm-hmm. And the great filmmakers do that. And it's always about the subtext. The horror films are never about, good horror films are never about what they seem to be about.
Right. Which is why I love zombies so much. They're like the prime example of that.
We've had how many years of zombies now? For the first 50 years of sound film, there were maybe 6 zombie films.
And most of those were like voodoo zombies.
Exactly, the voodoo zombies, right. And then since 1968, we have had gazillions of them. I mean, and there's some like major cultural change that created that interest in zombies. Mm-hmm. And it's scary to think about what that cultural change is. And so there's lots to talk about when you get to zombies.
So what kind of research do you do? I mean, is this just knowledge you've been building up over decades, or do you actually like dive into a film and say, like, I need to even find out more?
Oh, I always want to find out more, but I have developed a lot of friendships in the movie industry over the years, but I always read and watch pretty much 100% of everything written and said about a movie before I present it on the air. So I kind of know, I even read the user reviews, on IMDb.
Yeah.
They always have those user reviews, and a lot of them are insanely idiotic, but I sort of read those as a way to assess the public's view of the film. You know, just the general public, just the mm-hmm. average guy's view of the film. And, but, you know, yeah, I do extensive deep background research on all of the films. And sometimes that's hard to do. I'm currently looking at one called Crocodile that was made in Thailand in the 80s. There's not a whole lot of information on Crocodile, but what there is very interesting.
What got you initially interested in film and heading down this path? Because, like, I know for me, it's my dad got me into film. And, you know, that was the start of all my craziness. But what was it that, like, really hooked you on pursuing this?
I was an investigative reporter at the Dallas Times-Herald. And the film critic job came open. And my friend was the entertainment editor. And I said to her, I said, you know, I'm exhausted. I'm doing all these investigative stories. And could I be the film critic for a while just to rest? And she said, yeah. And I said, you know, until you get a real one. And so I started, and she said, you know, you have to review all the movies, right? I said, yeah, okay. And so by the second week, I said, I'm not seeing the screenings for some of these movies that are at the drive-in. And she says, oh, we don't review those. I said, you don't review those? Those look really interesting to me. Plus, some of those are what I would go to anyway, even if I wasn't a film critic. And she's like, no, we don't review those. And so I said, well, I'm going to start reviewing them. And so I was really the first guy to review movies for a mainstream newspaper and not consider them disposable trash. And the first guy who befriended my column, well, one of the first guys was Stephen King. He had a family member who lived in Dallas and would send him the column every week. And he wrote me a fan letter. And then Roger Corman, the legendary B-movie producer, became a fan of the column. And other people became fans of the column. And so it just grew from there. But my tastes were populist tastes. They were not art film tastes. Although, when I was the film critic, that was the two kinds of films I liked. I didn't like the Hollywood mainstream films, but I did like the drive-in premieres. They usually play for 1 week and you never see them again. And I liked the foreign films. So I became a fan of foreign and what I call drive-in films or exploitation films.
Did you ever think that job was going to lead you to where you are today?
Never. I mean, even after I started doing it for the movie channel, I thought it was kind of a sideline. I had done an article for Rolling Stone on the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2. I went down to where they were filming it. And the only reason they wanted me to do it is because Dennis Hopper was in it, and Dennis Hopper was coming out of rehab, and they wanted me to interview Dennis Hopper. And so that article was seen by a lot of people, and among those people were the programmers at the movie channel. And they said, "What would you come and host these sort of crappy movies that we show on Friday night?" And they would go over to the film markets in Europe and buy all these crappy movies. And so I said, sure. What they didn't realize is I liked them. I liked those movies. Did a month's worth. It was just me sitting in a Lazy Boy recliner with steer horns on the back. And so I did every Friday night for a month. And they said, hey, that was fun. And they invited me back for the next month. And then the next month. And then the next month. And then the next month. And it became a job, and the set got bigger and bigger and bigger. I was there 11 years. It was really just a guest thing. I was there 11 years. I don't think we ever had a contract. I was just like, hey, you're coming back again, aren't you? And I was like, yeah. And so even though it was an 11-year job, it was never very formal. And then they changed formats, and they weren't going to show that they were going to have that kind of programming anymore. I was off the air only about 2 months because programmers at TNT said, hey, we have this show called Monster Vision. We're looking for a host for it. You want to come over here and give it a shot? And I was like, well, sure. I said, actually, I have these sets. I said, oh, you do? And I said, yeah. And so we actually used the same sets.
You know, a lot of people write me and say, hey, Joe Bob Briggs, just what is Monster Vision? You don't need no special glasses or an insect's head. Just a healthy love for slime and disrespect for the dead. We'll talk about some movies by the old double wide. And when you get that creepy feeling creeping up inside, well then you got monster vision, it's a heck of a fright. We're tearing the heart out of Saturday night. These monster vision movies serve a primitive drive. Cause watching people die can make you feel so alive. So throw away your clicker now, the flicks have begun. Cause there's nothing you can do while fully dressed, it's as fun as watching TNT beneath the bug zapper light. we're tearing the heart out of Saturday night.
Tearing the heart out of Saturday night.
Tearing the heart out of Saturday night.
I went over to the TNT, and they didn't have any late night programming, so they didn't really care what I did. I would just do the exploitation films that were in their library. And it was an extensive library because Ted Turner had bought everything MGM owns. And then they licensed a lot of stuff beyond that. And so it was a good library to choose from.
Well, what I love about the way you approach all this is that no matter how low the budget might be or how bad some people may think the films are, you always treat them with respect. And there's not, like, we run a program here with a friend of mine runs something called Bonkers Ass Cinema, and it's the half-ass midnights. And he's real big about, like, no, I don't want you to watch these ironically or from this place of superiority. It's like, these films, like, people are really trying to make these movies, and there's a passion in them that you sometimes don't find in, like, Hollywood movies or Hollywood products.
That's true. There are exceptions. There are cases, and you can always spot them, where capitalists of one sort or another, you know, financiers have said very cynically,
yeah,
let's make a movie about this. And they're not true believers in horror. They're not horror fans. They're not exploitation movie fans. They're just like, hey, if we put these elements together, we could probably get these rubes to watch the movie. And so they feel superior to the audience. And that always comes through. It always comes through. And those are kind of the only ones that I don't like.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, I agree. I don't like that so bad it's good. There have been other hosted shows on some networks that are all about so bad it's good. And I don't believe in so bad it's good. I believe in so flawed that it's fascinating.
Well, also, I don't like the term, like, guilty pleasure. Like, no, if I enjoy it, I'm not going to feel bad about it.
That's another one. Yeah, I agree with you.
And I find it annoying that, you know, Riff Tracks will make fun of the films I like when they should be making fun of Forrest Gump and Barbie.
Well, that's true. I mean, sometimes MST3K makes fun of films that I've actually given 4 stars to. So, you know, that brings me up short.
Well, I want to thank you very much for speaking with me. And I'm really looking forward to Walpurgis Not and finding out which films you will be showing.
All right. I appreciate that. I always try to beat the drum for Walpurgis Not night. And it is next Friday, May 2nd. We're actually doing it one day late. We should have done it on May 1st, but we come on Friday night. So if you are celebrating Walpurgis Not, please join us.
That was Joe Bob Briggs, host of The Last Drive-In on Shudder. His Walpurgis Not show is this Friday. That wraps up another edition of KPBS listener-supported Cinema Junkie. If you enjoyed the podcast, then please share it with a friend, because your recommendation is the best way to build an addicted audience. You can also help by leaving a review. And check out Cinema Junkie Presents Midday Movies video podcast on the KPBS YouTube channel. On Friday, we'll debut an episode all about Ryan Coogler's Sinners. Till our next film fix, I'm Beth Accomando, your resident Cinema Junkie.
KPBS On Demand is supported by Paint Care, offering households and businesses in California more than 800 leftover paint drop-off sites for recycling. Quantities of 100-plus gallons of paint may qualify for a large volume pickup. Learn more at paintcare.org. KPBS On Demand is supported by the San Diego County Toyota Dealers, presenting the new 2025 Camry with refined design and performance. Visit your local Toyota dealer to learn more about all the features the new 2025 Camry offers. The San Diego County Toyota Dealers. We make it easy.